Welcome back to the Sweat Elite Podcast. Today, we've got the action with Max, myself, Matt Fox, co-founder of Sweat Elite, Alex Gula, COO of Sweat Elite. This is going to be our second episode with the three of us. So hopefully our new formation is the triad leads to some continued better banter for everyone. Today, we're going to be going over a massive boxing marathon recap. Matt was there in person, boots on the ground. We've got lots of stuff to talk about with that. We're previewing the second World Marathon Major of the Year and in London this coming weekend. And we're talking about some fast times coming out of the NCAA, specifically from Colin Salmon and Parker Valby, some of those implications on the U.S. Olympic team selection. Recapping Aussie national champs, preview the first Diamond League meet of the season in Xiamen, China, coming up this weekend. And we've also got another marathon out of Rotterdam, not technically a world major, but still plenty of international implications coming out of there this past weekend. Guys, great to be back for me. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, thanks so much, Max. And thanks for joining also, Alex. Really appreciate the time and the intro. But just before we get started, huge thank you to Pillar Performance, who sponsor this podcast series. I have been a huge fan of them for, probably over 18 months now and take it pretty consistently until I run out on the road. And then I'm frantically trying to tell them where to send it to when I'm traveling, which is always a bit of a challenge. But I do try and keep it on the list of supplements that I take every single day. Max, you've been taking it now for a little while. How are you feeling?
I'm pretty attached to it, to be honest. The other night, my girlfriend wanted to go to bed immediately, and I hadn't yet taken my Pillar Performance. And much to her chagrin, I insisted that I go back downstairs, slam my Pillar Performance, because at this point, I know my sleep quality is so good with it. I'm pretty scared to find out what happens to my sleep quality without it. So yeah, not looking forward to, I need to order some more so I don't run out after I finish up this pineapple coconut flavor that I got going right now, the triple magnesium.
We'll make sure you get some more very soon. So guys, huge thank you to Pillar Performance, where we're referring to the triple magnesium powder. And you can score 15% off your first order by going to Pillar Performance website and using the code SWEAT15. And if you're in the United States, that will be at the feed with the same promo code SWEAT15 to score 15% off your first order. Alex, how are you doing?
Great. Good to be back. A lot of action to talk about this week. I think we'd start off with the Boston Marathon recap. I know Max was excited to get going on this one. Max, biggest winners, biggest losers. What's up with that?
I was excited, but I was also the only one out of the three of us who was not there. Boots on the ground. Matt, you were on course. Alex, you were on the side of the course. I got some cool videos from you over text. Why don't we start with what was it like? What were both of your Boston Marathon experiences like? Because you guys were actually there. People don't want to hear. I was watching it on my phone here in Boulder. People don't want to hear about that experience. People want to hear about what did it smell like? What did it feel like?
Yeah, so I got to the finish line. So I initially thought that on TV, you could see there's like a grandstand at the finish line where there are like some bleachers. And I guess I foolishly thought that you didn't need to buy tickets for that. You could just show up and just whoever was there would just be able to sit on those bleachers, but that was not the case. So they let just normal spectators go until about maybe like 100 meters before the finish line. So that's where I was. And it was pretty exciting. Whenever start off with the wheelchair athletes, whenever the wheelchair athletes came through, people would make a lot of noise, help get the athletes to the finish line. But once the runners started coming through, it was the same thing. It was really exciting. I guess the best experience was whenever the 230 marathoners, the 240 marathoners were coming through and these guys were on their last legs and someone would take a tumble and the whole crowd would just get behind that person and like basically lift them up with their voices and push them on to the finish. So that was probably the most exciting part on my end.
Yeah, no said. So I'm not going to speak specifically to my race because that's not what people want to hear on this podcast, but I can say that. So I ran the race. That'll be on a different podcast, but I was in the race. I was running around the 235 pace for the majority of the race until I cruise it in. But I can say that it definitely lives up to everything. It lives up to the hype. For me, though, personally, like I've been to a lot of the major marathons and run a lot of the major marathons. And it's very similar in terms of crowd, depth of field, and so on and so forth. But yeah, I cruised the last couple of miles because I was having some cramping. But it was actually really fun to do that and just be walking basically past the crowd in the final miles because it is really loud. And Alex said, like, there was a few people that were cramping around me And the crowd's just rallying around them, being like, come on, get to the finish. And I'm looking at the poor guys being like, yeah, you probably don't realize it's actually pretty difficult to run with cramps. But like, I really appreciated the fact that there was like such strong support from the crowd of just pushing people to the line. And that final 400 meters or 500 meters or however long it is when you turn on the final stretch there is, yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Pro tip, if you can run Boston, maybe it was pretty warm yesterday. So a lot of people didn't really achieve the goals that they wanted to achieve, I feel like, because towards the end it was pushing 70 degrees Fahrenheit. I think Max, you said one of your friends mentioned that it was high 60s towards the very end. And that was when I was coming through, which is pretty high in the field. So
yeah,
people that are coming in 3.5 hours, it's probably over 70 degrees. So my point is, I think sometimes you just got to put the time aside and enjoy the experience. But yeah, phenomenal event. Really cool to be at. But let's talk about the elite results. Obviously, I didn't see it because I was half an hour to an hour back. But Alex, you were at the finish line. And I guess we can go through the biggest winners and the biggest losers of the on the men's and the women's side.
Yeah, just starting out on the men's side, Cissé Lema won, going out like in a blazing pace. He was on basically world record pace on the Boston Marathon course, which is pretty unprecedented. But
the first half is downhill. That is an important caveat. The fastest way to run Boston is probably a slight positive split. I do think that is an important caveat to throw out there as we really get into technically analyzing these performances. But yeah, Alex, go on.
And me and Max were just going back and forth towards the end there. It looked like Lema might have been able to get caught by some of the chase pack, but I think the announcers actually made a mistake saying that he dropped a 5:52 mile in there.
The commentators were passed a time card. So the women start 20 minutes later than the men. It might actually be, was it more than that? But the women are significantly further back in distance than the men. And the women were running 2:26 pace through 21 miles. So when the men were in the sort of the last 10K of the race, the women were still, I think, 25K or a little before. And for parts of the first half of the women's race, really the first 20 miles of the women's race, they were jogging. So one of the commentators was handed a card by analyst David Monty that said a given mile split was 5:52. And this was, I think, the 22nd or so mile for the men, but it was back 13th, 14th, 15th mile for the women. And the mile split said 5:52. And the commentator said that was Lema's most recent mile. In reality, it was the women's most recent mile. And this is one of the difficulties of trying to commentate on, there's two events happening at the same time. And not that this podcast is really just for harping on the broadcast, but not only was that difficult, but also the camera is just on Lema the entire time. And I'm staring at my phone, staring at multiple different leaderboard screens, trying to get a sense of time gaps and time splits, because the only way to know what's happening with Evans Chebet, Cyprian Cota, John Carrier, like those guys who were chasing, and was to try and figure out what was going on the leaderboard, because the feed just showed Lema. And he didn't look great, but his slowest mile was 5:27, and that was the uphill 21st mile on Heartbreak Hill. And he definitely, even though he didn't look great, it was pretty clear that he wasn't running almost 6-minute pace. So when they said 5:52, I was like, well, he looks bad. He doesn't look that bad. You can get a sense of how quickly the camera's going by and how quickly things are moving. And there's a big difference between 10 miles an hour and 12 miles an hour, and or 5:50 and 5:10. And yeah, it was pretty significant that that seemed really weird. Alex and I immediately did the math and figured, okay, can he get caught running this pace? And the answer was, if he'd run a 5:52, he was most definitely going to get caught. But he wasn't running 5:52. So I think that mile split, in fact, was actually closer to about 5:05. Yeah, Lema held on. But there was some drama there for sure. Alex, you said to me, I think probably it was mile 18, 19, 20. You said to me very confidently, you were like, Lema's winning this race. It's a question as to if he's going to run 203, 204, 205, 206. We had no idea how much he was going to fade, but you were like, Lema's winning this race for sure. And there was probably 8K, maybe 10K of the race where we weren't sure. So the men's drama was there a little bit, but not to move on from the men's race immediately, but it was nothing compared to the women's race, which we'll get to in a sec.
Yeah, well said. You are right. I just ran the thing 2 days ago. The first half is downhill, and many people would already know that. And I think you're dead right, Max, and probably more a topic to expand upon in our other podcast series. But I think slightly positive splitting Boston does make a lot of sense, because the second half is significantly, there is a lot of elevation gain. It's actually, I think, still a net downhill, but all of the big rises are in the second half. To go out a little bit faster.
I do want to throw out, it's not only just that they're big rises, it's the fact that you have to pound downhill makes, you know, that is what makes the second half slower as well. Even if it's a net downhill, you don't want to be running that quickly downhill either, because even though from a velocity perspective, it's not going to be more difficult running downhill, from a cumulative fatigue perspective, the fact that you're running minus 1%, minus 2% gradients is actually going to significantly slow you down and tire you out. So I just wanted to add that caveat to it being a net downhill. It is an unforgiving net downhill.
Yeah, it's such a challenging course, but I guess that's why it's so loved by marathoners. It's just such a hard one to conquer. But I think someone at the end asked me, they said, Lemma went out in 60 something. And I thought to myself,
60.19.
And I thought to myself, yeah, but if I was going for a half marathon PR, that first half of Boston would be a pretty good shot because it's pretty quick. But like you said, that accumulative fatigue in your, especially in your quads going downhill, will catch up to you later in the race. But put that aside, I think Max, you actually said something funny to me on the phone yesterday. You said Lemma was really hating life in the final 5 miles by the looks on his face.
He wasn't having fun. Type 2 fun. It's fun when it's over.
Exactly. But yeah, I was a little bit disappointed for Zuhair Talbi. He ended up in, I think it was 2:10 and went out in 62 and a half. I'm not exactly sure what happened there. Have you guys heard anything?
So I was watching again, it was incredibly frustrating. While the women are jogging and their race is 20 deep, right? Like you have 20 women laid across the road. There are more women in it later than any other previous edition of the Boston Marathon, right? Really, almost any other world marathon major. The women there have been previous editions of the race where the pace has actually been a little bit slower, but it speaks to the depth of field that they put together in Boston this year. Not only were they not really running, they're not going after it, but they weren't jogging. They weren't running 6 minute miles. They're still running 5:40s, 5:40s, 5:45s, 5:35 to 5:50 range. The women's race is 20 deep. Nothing's happening at all. At the front of the men's race, you got Lemma struggling to hang on. But the drama was happening in the moves and the mind games that were being played by the chase pack. And to some extent, it's like bike racing almost. Bike racing, the guy who sits on the front and makes the move to catch a solo rider or a group who's up the road is, in effect, someone who's often sinking their own race because they're doing that work. And that was really what seemed to be going on in the chase pack here. But the problem is we had no shot of anything. We had no idea what was actually happening. And going back to Talbi, it looked like Talbi did make a move. And again, is this move because he's like, all right, I'm going to take the bull by the horns and I'm going to spearhead the chase to go and get Lemma, or because he wants to run for second? That's up for debate, and it would have been really nice to see that, because if we were able to lay eyes on it, we'd get a better sense of it. But you have this problem where a lot of the guys in the chase pack, they feel like if they're the ones to really turn on the gas and start to drop faster splits to go chase Lemma down, then they might be sinking their own race, and they're trying to preserve their chances of landing on the podium. So we didn't get to see any of that play out, but Talbi did go for it. There was a split on somewhere after 35. Somewhere after 30K, 35K, where it seemed like he was a few seconds. I think it was less than 10 seconds for sure, but it was more than 2 or 3 seconds up on the rest of the field. But then I think by the time the next split came by, he'd gotten swallowed by that group that we previously mentioned, which was sort of John Carrier, Cyprian Cota, Evans Chebet. I forget the name of the guy who got second eventually because he came out of nowhere. Alex, you remember?
Yeah, Mohamed Issa.
Yeah. So he got swallowed by the group. So Talbi was not just from that split and that little, again, would have been great to have seen, but from that little bit that I got from the leaderboard, it was clear that Talbi wasn't just content to try and run in 2:10 and get 10th. He definitely did try to make a move. Was it the smartest one? We really don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, just some insight into Talbi. He posted on Instagram after the race a long paragraph, and he said that around 15K, he got a side stitch. And he didn't want to take fluids because he didn't want the stitch to get worse. But then that was actually a poor decision. And then he just said, like, he wasn't feeling good and his legs started to tighten up around 35K. And then, I don't know, the second point that he made, like, outside of the actual race was dealing with Ramadan over the last month. I don't know that when he typed that, I was confused just because last year when he came fifth in his debut marathon and it was like his breakthrough and it was such an amazing performance for him, that Boston Marathon was actually during Ramadan. Like, this Boston Marathon was, I think, a week after Ramadan ended. But that Boston Marathon was during Ramadan. So obviously Ramadan's really difficult to deal with, the fatigue and all that stuff. But yeah, so that's what he said. Any insight, Matt?
Yeah, I think having experienced, my fiance participates in Ramadan. I think you never know. There's a lot of celebration that goes around the month of Ramadan. And sometimes Muslims end up joining festivities through the evening. It's a very big celebration, of which there's often very random events. We don't know about Talby's Ramadan celebrations, obviously, but having been around this culture for some time now, I can say it wouldn't surprise me too much to learn if he did a little bit of evening celebrations. And that just includes just being around people in the culture and having a lot of meals for the most part. We have no idea, but I agree with you that it is a little bit strange that last year he was able to perform super well. I think maybe he's just underestimating the heat there. But guys, I think we should move on to the women's a little bit. But the final thing I just do want to say about the men's is CJ Albertson. Max, we spoke a little bit about this yesterday on the phone as well. Running sub 2:10 in Boston. I've got this automatic response because I'm so driven by times and performance.
Before we go to CJ, can I throw one more thing out on Talby and Ramadan? I just want to, last year, Boston Marathon, it was raining. And if you're unable to take fluids, you're getting some relief from the rain, right? The rain is helping to cool you down. Obviously here, he was religiously able to take fluids because Ramadan was over, but if he didn't want to take fluids because of his side stitch, he's out in the sun instead of getting some rain put on him. So I think that could have an impact. That just, when you're talking about that just jogged in my memory. The rain could have made a difference. Some people run better in the rain because it's going to cool you down, right? Core body temperature is an incredibly part of marathon performance. But yeah, sorry, Matt, back to what you were saying about CJ.
No, I'm glad you intercepted there because that's very true. And I always find it interesting that you're so familiar with this stuff. Being a triathlete, you would know that core body temperature is a huge deal in the marathon. And yesterday it was very warm, especially towards the end. So he might have been underestimating that part. But speaking to CJ and what I was about to say, and we spoke about this yesterday, Max, 2:09, I'm always telling people yesterday that had a performance that maybe they didn't want to, a time that they didn't want to run. I'm telling everyone around the 2:30 mark, the 3-hour mark, that on a flat course in reasonable weather, it'd be 3 to 4, maybe upwards of 5 minutes faster. And who knows? It depends on the person, depends on how much hill training they've done, depends how well they deal with the heat. But I think CJ running 2:09 in these conditions on Boston, Max, I think he's never let go of the thought that he has a 2:06 in him on the right course.
I completely agree. I completely agree. And no, we both echoed this when we were talking on the phone after the race. I think that CJ, we look at several aspects of his performance and he's run so many suboptimal marathons. He's never really put himself in a position to really succeed. We think about some of his best marathon performances. He's run 2:09:58 on a treadmill. He doesn't count that as real time, but yeah, it's worth something. Right. But the point is, he's done some ridiculous stuff in context and he's never landed a pure finish time that without context reads as a nuts performance. So he's done that 2:09 on a treadmill. He's run 2:10, 2:11 back to back, I think three times inside about 6 or 7 weeks. He has several years ago, I think it was whether it was 2018 or 2019, the Boston Marathon, he went out in 63 minutes, dropped the field by, I think, about a couple minutes at halfway, got caught at about 20 miles. But this has been something that I've long held to, is that he was actually running in inferior shoes. At that point, Brooks were not actually making a PBAX based super shoe. He was running in the Brooks Hyperion Elite Ones, which I've heard great things about the current Brooks Hyperion, and that is a genuine super shoe. But for the first generation, similar to Hoka and Aone, their super shoe was just an EVA foam based shoe with a carbon plate, which is negating most of the lab tested benefits of super shoes, which come from that supercritical foam. So I've actually been of the opinion that if CJ had ripped up his Brooks contract that morning and thrown a pair of genuine super shoes that morning, I think he actually would have won that race, whether it was 2018 or 2019 Boston Marathon, that he really went out hard halfway. But that's a tinfoil hat idea for another time. But still, that was a very impressive performance. And then this year at the Olympic Trials, he came fourth. I don't know if you can say he mistimed it, but He was 10 seconds away from, he led a career beat him by 10 seconds. Obviously in that race, Clayton Young, Connor Mance were the class of the field. But you could say maybe CJ, had he played his cards better, he could have landed on that Olympic team. And then we come back here, he still went out pretty quickly and he gets that sub 210, but splits were not even and his buildup was not ideal. And the conditions were not ideal, as you said, Matt. And Alex, you were about to throw something out as well?
Yeah, I was just going to say, he also, in his pre-race interview, said that he wasn't even feeling that good going into this race. After
said
the trials.
He said he had some foot problems between the trials and now, right?
Yeah, and he said that, he said it was a shortened build. He didn't get up to top volume that he wanted to get up to. And so I agree with both of your takes that he's a much faster marathoner. I would like to see him on Chicago in 2024 in October. He's never run Chicago. The fastest course that he ran was Valencia in 2022, but he DNF'd. So
I do have some insight on his build. So CJ is apparently a phys ed professor teacher and a track coach at Clovis Community College in California. And this has impacted his build up between the trials and Boston in several ways. One, his foot has been bothering him, and because he's had to be on his feet teaching or coaching, he hasn't really been able to give it the rest that he said that he would want to give it in order to rehab and then bank some better workouts. But secondly, he has been helping his students and athletes by apparently, and I have to give credit here, that I learned this on listening to the Let's Run podcast this week. He apparently has hopped into these sort of lower level college meets, and he has paced like back to back to back to back heats of the 5K in presumably something around his marathon pace, probably between 1450 and 1540, right? Somewhere near his marathon pace, and just run, I don't know how many of them. I don't know if it was 3, 4, 5, 6, but I'm assuming it was more than several. And apparently this is something he did multiple times. So that's how he would dial in marathon pace. He runs 5K marathon pace. He gets the 45 second break or whatever. When the heat finishes up, they get the next heat of runners on the track. He probably has to cross the field to get from the finish line to the 200 meter mark where the 5K starts. And then he runs his next 5K at roughly marathon pace. And that's apparently how he's prepared. CJ's always been one to do it his own way. And I think that's remarkable.
That's such a good idea. I think those workouts are really hard to do solo. And I know he does a lot of his training solo. And I think that's, and then to be able to help a group of people too in pacing, that's brilliant. I'm glad you shared that. Alex,
awesome.
We can talk about the women's field before we spend the entire podcast speaking about the Boston men's race. Some pretty phenomenal stats coming from this one. We spoke last week about predicting the winners. We were very close to the mark. Well, we basically predicted that Obiri, Lats, you predicted that Obiri would win. But Alex, let's hear more about what it was like at the finish line for the women's race.
Yeah, I think there's a general consensus that the women's race was just a lot more exciting than the men's race, because as people were coming through on Boylston, Lemma came through, then Asa came through, then Chebec came through. It wasn't really a race. Everyone knew who was going to win. But when Obiri came through and Lakati was like basically right there, like 5 seconds behind or 10 seconds behind, people thought that it was a race.
I think we knew by that point. I think we knew the race was over by midway through the 26th mile. So by the time you get to the final 400 meters, I think the race is probably over. But I imagine that for the fans who were lining the last 3K of that race, I believe that Obiri located in the 25th mile or right close to around maybe 20, you know, maybe up to sort of 25.2 with a mile to go. So I think that the last mile of that race was, I will say it was boring, but I think that we look at the way those women are running on and the size of the gap. I was watching it. I think, Alex, I think you said that by the time that the men's winners started to come through, you put your phone away and had stopped watching the stream. Were you watching it live? Were you watching the final miles of the women's race live before you saw them in person? Or were you focused on the action that was happening in front of you?
I was focused on the action that was happening in front of me, but you were texting me that she dropped multiple 440 miles.
So, okay. So I was watching. So Matt was running. Alex was watching the winners come through. I was watching this on TV, and this was absolutely phenomenal. So first, I want to give some massive credit to our own Matt Fox here. Matt said that he was basically like, it's a toss-up. He's, if we were to go Vegas betting odds, he's, I think it could be a toss-up between Lokady and Obiri. And what I want to throw out here, obviously, this isn't a visual podcast, but I shared this with Matt. This is inside. This is the last aid station. If we don't, I don't know if we know where the last aid station is. But Matt was like, I'm not sure who to pick here. This is a, what I'm showing Alex and Matt right now is a screenshot on my phone from the stream of Locati and Obiri stride, literally stride for stride. They're at the same phase of their stride.
It looks like
Locati's arm is tucked behind Obiri, but they're both, their left leg is lifted. Looks like Obiri might be a little higher in her stride than Locati is, but yeah, it's almost, that's in the final 5K of the race. But going backwards a little bit, we had a group of 20 and we had a group of 20 through halfway. I think that might've taken us pretty close to 20 miles. The 21st mile is up Heartbreak Hill, and that was a 5:47 mile, but that might have actually been picking up the pace a little bit because that mile is so uphill. But either way, they were on 2:26 mid shape through 21 miles. And then in the last 5.2 miles of this race, they ran 30:38 10K pace, which is 4:55 a mile. And that is also under the Olympic standard for the 10K. That's in the closing 5.2 miles of the Boston Marathon. Now, it's not a complete 10K, right? But still, and there are some even faster splits in there. So the race really happened in sort of the 24th and 25th miles. So going back a little bit, big group comes through 20 miles, 21st miles up Heartbreak Hill. I think up Heartbreak Hill, we saw that group of 20 whittled down to about 11. And then after it whittled down to about 11, we saw the American Emma Bates get spat out the back. She was there, and then one moment she was there, and one moment she was just not. And then pretty quickly after that, we saw a group of three form, and it was Helen Obiri, Sharon Locati, and Edna Kiplinger. And that's when the race really started. Sometime, and I think in miles 22, 23, we saw Kiplagat got dropped. Huge shout out to her. She's 44 years old, lands on the podium of the Boston Marathon. Very inspiring for sure. But miles 24 and 25 were really where things heated up. And it was in the 24th mile, Obiri ran a 4:41 mile, which is the fastest mile in women's marathoning ever. Wow. And the remarkable thing there, and both women gave interviews after the race, and they said how hard it was and how they wasn't this 4:41 mile. Maybe you can say that Obiri was feeling a little bit better and it was probably a little bit more her initiative. But Sharon knew that if she wanted to win this race, she still had to really put the hurt on Obiri. And that means continuing to lift the pace with Helen as Helen was making those moves as well. That 4:41 mile did not come with any attack. It just came from Obiri just grinding out this really tough pace. Her coach, Dathan Ritzenhain, did say last week prior to the race that he believes she was in 2:11 shape last year, which obviously is the world record. World record and still would not, that's not a Boston Marathon 2:11, that's a Berlin Marathon 2:11, but still remarkable fitness to sort of cite. And we've heard crazy things about her doing long runs, dropping 27 flat 10K guy Joe Klecker in long runs up at altitude above Boulder, Colorado. But yeah, so this is the fastest mile in women's marathoning ever. And the thing was, that mile did not shake Locati. It was that Helen stayed on the gas and ran a 4:52 for her 25th mile, which resulted in an 8:57 3K split and a 15:06 5K split. 15:06 5K split, just for contrast, only four women in the NCAA system in the United States have ever run that fast, and one of them happened this weekend. This is in the middle of the Boston Marathon. Yes, it's slightly downhill, but you've also been running pretty tough. It wasn't marathon pace for them, but it was pretty tough pace for over 20 miles before that. But yeah, there's that 4:52 mile that continued the really hard pace at that 4:41 24th mile, and that just broke Locati. And all of a sudden, there was no attack. All of a sudden, the string just popped. And the gap was instantly, I think I texted Alex, I was like, there's instantly a gap. And it was instantly 5 meters. And then pretty quickly after that, I'd say within a minute after that, it was about 50 meters. And that was the race. Locati hung really strong, but I think that by the time that they got to Boylston and that the closing kilometer of the race, I think that it was probably pretty decided. Obiri just had to hang on. But before I turn it over to you guys, the one other thing that I'll say from watching it is it's really interesting because both Kiplagat, Locati, and Obiri all have a stride that is not very aesthetically pleasing. It's incredibly efficient and it works for them. But that made following this race from an analyst perspective very difficult because all of them look, quote, bad, right? None of their strides look very good. So it's tough to tell who's hurting and who's not because they all have this. Katie throws her feet out to the side. Miri has a very unique stride as well. So that made it interesting as well. But yeah, phenomenal race. The last 10K of this women's race was superb.
Yeah. And for context, that's 2:08 marathon pace at the in that final split as well. So yeah, a little bit downhill, but yeah, crazy scenes. Here you go, Alex.
Yeah, I think just moving forward, what does this Boston Marathon result for the women have? What effect does it have on the selection committee, especially for Kenya?
Obiri's on the team. Obiri's on the team. There's no doubt about it. That is solidified. Obiri's on the team. I think the question is, she the favorite for Olympic gold?
My question to is Lokedi on the team? She was named to the 6-woman shortlist, but do they take her or is she just out because she lost to Obiri and someone like Ruth Chepngetich, who ran 2:15 at Chicago in October, does that solidify her
spot?
Well,
Ruth is running this weekend in London, right?
I think so, yeah.
So I think that's probably what we're going to see. I do also want to throw it out there. John Galt made the point that is Lokedi's performance in this race, despite losing, better? Is this a better Sharon Lokedi than the Sharon Lokedi who got second in Boston this week? Is this a better runner than the Sharon who won New York last year because of her ability to hang on with these really fast splits?
I think we're going to find out the answer to that during the Olympics. If Helen Obiri wins the Olympics, then undoubtedly this will be her best performance because she lost the Olympic champion while still holding on to her in those final few miles. But if this was if she doesn't win the Olympics or if she doesn't perform as well, I feel like that winning New York City is just, it's too hard to compete with winning a major versus coming in second.
But this was, we're going to see this now. All of these races are tossing out. We have the most sub-2:19 or sub-2:18 or sub-2:20 women ever. But that's because there are more of those women now than there ever have been before. So the races are going to continue to get deeper. And it's going to be tough to analyze. We're in the middle of this renaissance of women's marathoning, right? Where world records are coming down like crazy. Top 20 marks are coming down like crazy. National records are falling. And seemingly every race, every major race is producing really historically noteworthy performances. It's going to be difficult to analyze. I don't think we need the Olympics to say that this is still, that New York City field that Lokedi beat is so much less deep than the field that she beat this week minus Helen Obiri. I think that there's definitely a point to be made, Olympics or not, this was the best run of her life.
That's true. I think we also need, going back to Matt's point, or actually Max's point about Ruth Chepngetich running the London Marathon, a bunch of these Kenyan and Ethiopians that didn't run Boston are running London. So it'd be hard to even try and shake up who's going to be in the Olympic team without having to see the results for London next week, which I think is a good segue into our London Marathon preview. Who are the major players on the women's side and men's side? Who do you guys fancy in this one?
Yeah, so I've been looking into this, and the women's field is wild. There is 10 women faster than 2:17:30. I haven't aligned that with the all-time list, but I assume that's probably the majority of, obviously Paula Radcliffe, 2:15, she's not there. She's but the majority of the top all-time list are in this
field. Prior to like 2019, 2:17:30, even though it was over 2 minutes slower than Paula Radcliffe's world record, that was like number two, number three, number four, the range of those other top five times. Paula Radcliffe was just a historical outlier for so many years.
Exactly. So we have the world record holder, 2:11, Assefa in the field. We have Bridget Koskaya, 2:14, Ruth Chepngetich, 2:14. Yeah, women are going after the women's only world record, which is 2:17:01, which is allowed in London because the women start separate to the men. Yeah, guys, what do you think is going to happen here?
Alex has thoughts.
I was just going to say 19 women ever have run sub 2:17:30.
Okay, so we are over 50% in this one race. It's going to be ridiculous, but I don't think that, let's say that some crazy shit goes down in London this weekend and we have fifth place is a running in the 2:13s, right? I don't think that actually makes the job of Kenyan athletics and Ethiopian athletics any easier, because no matter how crazy, if Tigas Assefa lowers her own world record or if Ruth Chepngetich becomes a 2:11 runner instead of a 2:14 runner, those things are 110% significant. But the London-style race is not the Olympic-style race. And to be honest, this Olympic course is going to be so hot and so hilly that it's going to be a whole, you contrast the London Marathon with the Boston Marathon, you probably have a whole other same degree of difference between the Boston Marathon and what we're going to see in Paris, just with the amount of elevation, some of the steepness of the gradients with some of the uphills and downhills, and also the fact that it's going to be in France in July, August, and it's going to be 67 degrees at the finish of the Boston Marathon this year or this week. It's probably going to be upwards of 10 degrees, maybe even 15 degrees warmer than that. So we have, I don't think that if a bunch of really fast times get smashed out of the park this weekend in London, I don't think that should overrule what Kiplagat, Lotedi, and Obiri did this past weekend, because it's just so much more the style of the Olympic marathon.
Yeah, you put it well there. I can say that because I've got quite a few people that I know running London, I've been looking at the forecast. The forecast looks absolutely perfect. It's going to be 8 degrees Celsius, which is like 47, 48 Fahrenheit, overcast. The London Marathon website says they're going for the women's only world record, sub 2:17.01. But given there's a bunch of women in this field that are 2:14, and obviously we have the world record holder, 2:11 in the field, I wonder if they're going to make a call before it to actually go for the world record, because London's a fast course. Let's remember, there's been very fast times set on that course. Kelvin Kiptum last year ran 2:01.25. He just missed the world record by, I think it was 16 seconds at the time or something like that. The world record can be broken in London. It doesn't state they're going for the world record. It states very clearly on the London Marathon website that Alex sourced the more specific link that they're going for the women's only world record, which is 2:17.01. But if you're at 2:11,
I'll tell you what it needs. Is it needs more than one person to be in sub 2:12 shape. Because the difference here with women's only versus the Berlin Marathon, where Assefa set that record, is she had male pacers through 30K. And the problem here is that there are, let's say Assefa shows up and she's in better shape. I think, let's say she's in 30 seconds better shape than she was in Berlin this past fall. I think that Assefa alone does not get the world record, because you need, I think, you need the help from others to get you through, even if it's just getting from halfway, getting from 21K to 30K. You need that. And if these other women are, even if they are in 2:12 shape, even if you have your Ruth Chepin-Gedich and people like Ruth Chepin-Gedich who run 2:14, even if she is now in 2:12 shape, it's not going to be enough. She doesn't just need a field pushing her from behind. She needs people to run with. So unless multiple women show up to contest the world record and they actually commit to it, we're not going to see it fall, because otherwise, you're just going to have someone running completely by themselves from halfway. And I don't think that's going to be a recipe for running a world record.
You're exactly right. But in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, there's a 2:11 girl, there's two 2:14 girls. We've got perfect weather. We're going for sub 2:17.01.
I don't think they're going for sub 2. But I think that they could run really fast. I think that three of the top five times ever could come from this weekend. But it's that, will they run faster than 2:11.53?
Yeah. Yep.
That, I think, is impossible unless you have three women who are not only all in shape to do it, but commit to do it together. And that is going to take, maybe it doesn't take three, maybe it only takes two, but I guarantee you can't do it alone.
London's a pace marathon, correct?
Yes, it is, but you're not going to have, you're talking female pacemakers.
You don't think female pacemakers can take them through halfway at 66
I don't think
minutes.
Halfway matters. I think 30K matters.
Yeah, Max is right. I think so too.
And I think that unless, but because this is such rarefied air, it's like kind of the same thing as, think about it like Americans trying to run sub 27 for 10K, right? That's such rarefied air for Americans that historically, if you want to run a fast 10K, you want to have if one of the three of us was to try to run 29:30 for 10K, there are so many guys out there who can do that, that we could easily get help and we could have someone take us to the last lap if we wanted to. If you want to run, if you're an American distance runner and you want to run 26:50, anyone who can actually be capable of taking you to a point that's really going to help you is probably also in shape to get to the line with you as well. And that's the problem here with these women's pacemakers, is that no one who can pace them, either the pacers are not going to be good enough, or if the pacers are good enough, they're in the race and they're contesting for the win themselves.
This is, you're right. I'm hearing Max say it's going to be very hard to go for the world record, but we have London Marathon, fast course, near perfect weather, and the world ranked all time 1, 3, and 4 in the race. So why wouldn't you go for the world record?
Because they have to commit. And if it, and it, it comes back to this thing where I was like, going back to discussing Talby, right? Talby and the chase pack chasing Lemma, is that it's going to take a selflessness.
Yeah.
Male pacers who are going, who are taking tickets to 7 through 30K in Berlin, that is their job. There's no, if they want to get paid well for their job and they want to, there's no act of selfishness or lack of selflessness that can make that job any better or worse, right? For those three women, and I completely agree with you, they could do it if they're all in shape. But if they not only have to all be in shape to do it, they have to all commit to work together. And that is where you see things, is that the win, and the London Marathon is a massive prize pot, right? If ostensibly you could say that the number 3 and 4 women are, if they're going to help Assefa get the world record, then they're probably just helping Assefa win, right? It's going to be really tough for them to commit to helping Assefa get her world record. Even if they were to run sub 212 on their own, it's going to be really tough themselves out of that group of three. It's going to be really tough to get the win, right? So they would have to collectively decide at 25K that they're going for it. And I just think that is tough.
Completely agree. And another point is that it's an Olympic year, and these, the 3 and 4, Bridget Koskaj and Ruth Trepin-Gedic, like of all time, 3 and 4, they're going to be competing with each other for a Kenyan Olympic spot.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it would take. They would really, like, I would be really impressed if they just went all committed to, like, trying to go for that world record and said, this is a glory that I want. I couldn't care less about helping other people or what it is. Or maybe that's just their strategy of trying to win the race and trying to get on the Olympic team, and it'll be, like, the craziest thing ever.
Do you keep in mind that you guys are American and making the Olympics is a big deal, but breaking a world record has a lot of bonus points on your contract.
But you still have to beat Assefa then. You still have to beat Assefa. Think about, I think that when we saw, this could be similar. We could have a situation similar to the Valencia half marathon in 2020 with the men, where, you know, no one had ever broken 58 minutes before. And then 5 dudes said, screw it. We're working together. We're taking this thing down. And they all ran between 57.36 and 57.41, right? That's, you've got the players and you got the fitness. But what they had, and what I would be very surprised if these women had it this week, is the collective spirit. We're going for it. And we are potentially, the guy who ran 57.41 there is the green. I will be part of history and I will have my claim to one of the fastest times ever, even if I don't win, but it's only happening because I committed to helping this group of guys run this time, right? The psychology that goes on, because this exists far more often in cycling than it does in running, where you have, it's exactly what I said was happening to men's field in Boston, potentially sacrificing your own second place in order to bring the field in reach of the win or the world record or whatever. In order for the group to collectively decide that, they all have to say, I'm okay with not winning, in order to give ourselves as a group a chance to knock this out of the park. But we see so many times in bike racing that does not happen, because so many guys are like, if I'm the one to put the win back on the table, then I'm not going to be the one who wins, right? And they're like, I'd rather get second and wait for everyone else to take the race and maintain my advantage because I'm racing defensively, than actually look at it. So many stages of the Tour de France, World Championships, One Day Classics have been won in this style simply because other people are scared to help each other, because in doing so, there's a massive risk that they're giving up their own win. So that's a psychology that I think is at work here. And yeah.
Very well said. Max, I must give you credit for your deep thinking about how marathon racing is run. And I tend to be persuaded by your opinion. So let's see what happens. We've spoken about the women for a long time. The men is also a pretty good race. We have Tamarat Tola.
This is London. Preview London in marathon. London, not recapping Boston. Yeah.
Yeah, we're still in London. seventh fastest man in history. The field isn't quite as strong, but it's still very strong. I think we have 12 or 11 guys under 205. But we have a pretty good race going on in the British guys. Alex, you can speak a little bit to that.
Wait, I have a question for you, Alex. If Mark Scott races well, could Mark Scott race as well into the British marathon, British Olympic marathon team here?
So, yeah, I was just gonna touch on that. So, Team GB has three spots, just like any other country. One of them is Phil Sessman, who ran 208.04 at Seville this year.
Beat Jake Whiteman at 3,000 meters in early 2022.
Emil Karais ran 208.07. They both have the automatic standard. And then there's three other guys. So then they have one more spot. And there's three other guys. Callum Hawkins, who ran 208.14 in 2019, is returning. Mark Scott's debuting. And Mark Scott's a world-class runner that could run under 208.10 in his debut marathon on a fast course with great weather. So another guy that's a good story that has a chance at making the Team GB Olympic marathon team is Mohamed, who had a great result in Valencia this year. He ran 208.40, and he's right outside the world ranking points for Team GB. So he's technically in the third spot right now, but all these spots are basically up for grabs because 208.10 is the auto standard, and the two guys for Team GB that have the spots have run 6 seconds and 3 seconds faster than 208.10. So those guys technically are going right now. Then there are three other guys who have not run that time at all and are not in the world ranking points that all have the potential to run under that time and under the times of the two guys that have already run the record. So therefore...
The standard, you mean?
The standard, not the record. Therefore, this is basically the Team GB men's Olympic marathon trials at the London Marathon.
I'll be watching now. I was probably going to watch a recap because I probably have to wake up pretty early here in Colorado to watch it. But I think that Alex might have just convinced me to wake up early before training it and watch this race, because holy shit, that is dramatic. And to some extent, I'll actually go out and say this might be un-American of me, but because you have enough guys, you have only two guys with auto standard, but conceivably this could be, I guess it isn't because... I was going to say, could this be more exciting than the U.S. Olympic trials? Because you don't have all this mess with the standard. You probably won't have the same mess with the standard. They will probably have three guys under 208.10 for the qualifying period by the time London's finished. But at the same time, Team GB does not auto-select based on finish order. I guess this isn't even a trial. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say. You get my point. This could be in some ways more dramatic than the U.S. trials because you don't have the standard mess.
Agreed.
I think Team GB is just going to take their three fastest guys. I think it does. I think the selection committee is just going to take the three fastest guys, whether they come from this race or not. And I personally think they will come from this race. Mark Scott's debut is highly anticipated. Broken 13 on the track and the 5K. He's recently switched from the Bowerman Track Club to the NN Run-In team.
It was less recent than we think. He's actually been there for quite a while. I think it was like over a year and a half, because he left Bowerman before people started to leave Bowerman like flies. He's been there for a while. He left Bowerman to move to the roads, as in the marathon. So this is a highly anticipated debut because it's been postponed for so long.
Yeah. He ran 62 minutes and a half in February in Barcelona. So he's in shape. Usually when these pro runners run a half in preparation for a marathon, they usually are planning on running only a little bit slower than that through the halfway point of their actual marathon.
I think that when you get to the level that these guys are at, they're actually reading into it a lot less than you think. They're going a lot more on feel. Taking an easy dub, just a good long run. I think Mark felt pretty good about that run. That's really, I think, what we take from it, is things are going well.
And just moving back to the open field rather than the British field, Kennedy Sibikele is in this race, and he stated he wants to make the Olympic team for the marathon for
no
Ethiopia this year.
Chance.
Don't count him out. The guy can come out of nowhere and run 2:01.
But he ran 63:59. Okay, he got beaten by Reed Fisher at the... No hate to Reed. Reed Fisher is a good runner, but Reed Fisher is not as good as the third best Ethiopian. Like, he ran, not only did he run 63.69, but he got like 7th or 8th in the New York City half, and he lost by 3.5 minutes. So it's because, yeah, the race we're talking about, Mark Scott ran 63.40, but he won that race by 4 minutes. And he's just out there by himself at a British local race. Kayla showed up to the New York City half, and I'm just going to say he shat the bed. Like, zero chance. Not zero, but far less than 50-50 for this man.
Let's just say, let's just assume that Cissé Lama is on the team because 201.48 didn't win the Boston Marathon. That's basically on the team.
Then I think Temerat Tola is on the team.
You think if Kenenisa Bekele beats Temerat Tola in the London Marathon, they take Temerat Tola and not Kenenisa Bekele?
I just don't think that's going to happen. I think that just going off of probability, I think that I'm saying, I think Temerat Tola is going to beat Bekele, and I think that Temerat Tola is going to be on the team. I think that, yes, if that happens, fair play, for sure. I just don't think it's going to happen.
I think the question lies in, has Bekele spent 6 weeks in the Netherlands or not before this race? Because if he has, don't count him out. But if he hasn't, then he's been in Ethiopia. I think we can potentially predict him.
Alex, is he on Strava? No way.
Bekele, no chance. He's racing. He's the sixth fastest guy in this marathon period for the Olympics for Ethiopia. And he's racing, I think, three of the guys in front of him. So if he does finish as the top Ethiopian, he has to go. There's no chance he doesn't go. It's funny, though, because...
There's no chance he finishes as the top Ethiopian.
And it's funny, though, because I think there's a lack of respect given to Bekele versus Kipchoge in the marathon from their respective federations. I feel like Kipchoge has had a spot on this Kenyan Olympic team no matter what, even though his results have not been that stellar. Bekele ran 204.19 in Valencia. That's still a very solid time.
Let's keep in mind, though, that Kipchoge is the reigning Olympic champ, so he probably has every right to have some respect to get on the next Olympic team. And he's won the last two Olympic Games.
Kipchoge has respect on his name for a reason. It's not like Bekele doesn't. The thing is that we think about Bekele's last several years, and they have been marred by inconsistency. That's inconsistency between good, very good performances and very shit performances. And it's like the video of that Italian soccer coach. Sometimes maybe good, sometimes maybe shit, right? And we look at Kipchoge. Kipchoge's had two bad races. And other than that, he's been phenomenal, right? Kipchoge's bad race, he still won Tokyo last year. And I think that, let's also put this in perspective. Yes, Kayla ran 204 in Valencia, but like Kipchoge's bad race was 206 in, sorry, he did not win Tokyo. Kipchoge's bad race was 206 in Tokyo, and Bekele's bad race was almost 64 flat at the New York City half. So I think I'll take a 206 over a 64 flat in terms of who gets de facto priority as a legend of the sport.
Points taken.
Let's see how this plays out. Jeffrey Kemmerwar has withdrawn from the race, so we won't see him there. But perfect conditions, it will be very interesting to watch. But guys, moving on, last couple of points. Max, we can speak a little bit to the NCAA results. Us all being in America, we're leaning more towards at least being able to watch the NCAA results here a little bit easier in the time zone and so on and so forth. But there was some interesting news this week, Alicia Monson and Parker Valley. Max, I'll let you take over.
So we got some shakeups. The U.S. The women's Olympic 10K team has actually been one of the biggest storylines so far of 2024, at least in my mind it has been. This is because we have the women's 10K Olympic A standard is one of the toughest standards out there in the sport right now at 30-40. Yes, you can make the argument that 27 flat is more difficult or at least as difficult, but more men are hitting that. And we're still going to see... We're going to see more men have a more normal process of getting selected to the Olympic trials because more of them are just going to have that standard than the women. Where with the women, it's all about who has this standard and who doesn't. And behind the standard, you have who has world rank points, who has points from world cross country, who has even simply winning the trials without the standard can possibly move world rank points around. We had this interesting scenario. And prior to this weekend, we had two U.S. women with the standard. They were Alicia Monson and Wayne Colati. And as of this weekend, Alicia Monson's season is over. She is out of the Olympics with meniscus surgery. I believe it's meniscus, Alex. And at the same time, Parker Valby, the 21-year-old American collegian, NCAA cross-country champion, NCAA 5K champion indoors, and NCAA 3K champion indoors, ran 14:52, take down the NCAA record, and win the indoor title this February. She makes her 10K debut, runs 30:50 by herself, wins the race by over a minute and a half. And second place was like 32:20. So laps everybody in the field and completely by herself. She had a pacer through 5K, but she also went negative. She went 15:30, 15:20. Doesn't get the standard, but this is noteworthy for several reasons. She could, in effect, get the standard via rankings points from running another strong 10K, either the NCAA regional meet, the NCAA championship meet. She could also win the U.S. trials in the 10K. Any of those things could bump her back into the conversation. This is also noteworthy because it's still ridiculous that we have an absolutely dominant woman in the U.S. in the NCAA scene who theoretically, as of right now, may not go to the Olympics because she hasn't just run 10 seconds faster. Which is a bit ridiculous. But this is a phenomenal performance. We've seen really great things from Parker Valby, but we were unsure how she'd go moving up from the 6K distance, which is the NCAA cross country women's championship distance, up to the 10K. And now it seems, all right, she's good at the 10K as well. She can run pretty fast. So that's pretty interesting. We'll see how that continues to develop, but probably pretty likely that Parker Valby goes to the Olympics for the United States. And it's also not outside the realm of possibility that she could be the top American at those games. Granted, Whiney Kalati ran 30:38 at the 10. That was in perfect conditions, perfect pacemaking, pace lights. Parker Valby did this completely by herself and after 5K. But with Monson out, Parker Valby, even though she doesn't have the standard yet and hasn't made the team yet, she could be the top American in the 10K. And she's also, if she continues on form, she'll demolish the NCAA 10K at those championships in June. But the other thing we want to talk about, other significant NCAA result, Colin Solomon, 21 years old, out of Northern Arizona University, former high school prodigy at Newbury Park High School in California, the same high school that has produced Nico Young, now the youngest sub-13 and sub-27 performer in American history, and the first NCAA performer to run sub-13 and sub-27 as well. Same high school. Colin Solomon ran the number 2 NCAA time all time in the 1500, running 3:33 for the win, beating Craig Engels and destroying the former NCAA 1500 champions from University of Washington, Nathan Green and Joe Wascombe, who both ran 3:42 and 3:43 respectively. That result is noteworthy, I believe, because only three other Americans of this age or younger have run that fast. And they are Jim Ryan, who set the 1500 meter world record in 1967 at the age of 19. A 19-year-old American kid ran 3:31 in 1967, broke the world record. Then we had Cole Hawker run 3:30 in the Olympic final in Tokyo, getting sixth. Had Hobbs Kessler run, what's his PB now? 3:31, 3:32 since then as well. So yeah, the reason why I want to talk about this, at least on the 1500 side here, is that like these American performers, these young American prodigies in middle distance running, have a track record of going on to very high success on the world stage, right? Cole Hawker, he ran a fast indoor mile in early 2021, and he went on to make the Olympic final and get sixth at those games. Hobbs Kessler got third on world indoors this year. So basically, it's worth paying attention to, because whatever's happening on the miling in the NCAA mile 1500 scene, it's going to have ramifications for the global championships the next few years after that, because there's some phenomenal talent in the NCAA system.
Well said.
Bit of a rant. Sorry.
No, you're good. Alex, you looked into the Diamond League coming up this weekend. What do we have to share?
Maybe the Diamond League kicks off. I feel like we've been talking about major marathons for many months now, but finally the Diamond League returns. GM in China. A few distance events, the men's 5K and the men's 800 and the women's 1500 and the women's steeplechase. In terms of the men's 5K, I think the notable people are Lemecha Gurma, world record holder in the steeplechase, and Ethiopian record holder in the 1500. Makes it, as I'm pretty sure, debut on the track in the 5K. Newly crowned Aussie champion Matthew Ramsden makes his Diamond League return. If he runs under the Olympic standard of 13:05, he'll basically have a spot locked up for Australia because they tend to favor their national champions. Munir Akbache from France, the super pacer, he will be pacing this race. Actually, I texted him last night asking him what the pace will be for this race. And he says they only decide it a day before, so in the athletes meeting, hopefully it'll be a quick pace. I assume sub-13 at the very least. Oscar Chelimo, bronze medalist from the 2022 World Championships, and Jacob Kiplimo's half-brother. He will be in this race as well. But this stacked field of a whole bunch of other Kenyans are in this race. Stuart McSwain's in this race. Sam Parsons in this race.
Mukhtar Idris, the man who took down Mo Farah's triple-double streak in London 2017, PB of 12:54, also in this race.
A big race, a whole bunch of good guys in the 5K.
Bunch of top sub-13s.
Moving on to the 800. Reigning world champion Marco Arap will be in China for that race. Peter Bol, who just finished second in Australian Championships from the Fast 8 Track Club. He's coming back from a knee injury, so hopefully he returns to form. I would probably hope to see like a 144 at the least for the win in China out of these guys. Clayton Murphy returns, 142 American, who has not been in the greatest form as of late, but hopefully he will return. He's been absent from the YouTube scene. He posted a few videos there for a couple of years, but left now. So yeah, I mean, that's on the men's side. The distance events will probably produce some fast times. They always do in the Diamond League. And I'm excited to see the Diamond League finally back after many months hiatus.
I don't know if there'll be too many updates from over there because they pretty heavily restrict the social media. I was actually in Xiamen maybe about 3 months ago on a connection. And yeah, they'll be on the internet. They'll be on the Chinese internet when they're there, which is a bit different to ours.
Alex, did you discuss the women's 1500 at all?
I did not, but it is stacked.
The women's 1500 is it's a world championship minus Faith Kipyegon. This is a remarkable. Matt, do you mind if I talk about this for a sec? Okay, so we've got the three Ethiopian phenom talents of Derebe Teje, 353 PB, Berke Hailem, 354 PB, and for women, Hailu, 355 PB. All three of those women were in the World Championship Indoor 1500 or Indoor World Championship 1500 this winter that just concluded. Also got American phenom Addy Wiley, who ran 359, I believe the age of 19. We've also got Worknesh Mesele, 357 seed. We've got sub-4 seeds out the ass here. This is going to be a phenomenal race. I think that most people are still picking Kipyegon for the win in Paris this year, but this is going to be a really great preview of what is sure to be one of the marquee middle distance events in Paris. I was just looking at the program, Alex, as you were going over it, and I'm just shocked that all these women are coming through for the very first meet of the year. So that's going to be really cool to see.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to Addy Wiley, only American women coming all the way to China. We need to see more. Like, all these distance events are just dominated by the Africans. We need to see more, and Europeans. We need to see more Americans in the Diamond League, no matter where they are. It's the premier event in the world. I don't care where it is. Like, these Americans need to be at the Diamond League events if they want to know what it feels like to run with the best in the world and not just get shocked at the World Championships and Olympics.
Totally. Great point. Matt's not going to be pleased that I brought this up, but I've got to say it. Ooh, this is not a sprinting podcast, and it never will be, but this 100 is Christian Coleman, Ronnie Baker, Akeem Blake, Johan Blake, Fred Curley. So that's going to be really cool. That's all I'm going to say about it. But stay to the end of the meet. Watch the 100.
We can drop in a bit of sprints and triathlon chat every now and then, or maybe a bit of field events. not a problem with me. But we did, Alex and Max, we both touched on Aussie champs and some results there. I guess we can round up the pod with talking about that for a few minutes and then also Rotterdam. But Aussie champs had a few shocks. There was a few interesting results.
Yeah, the men's 1500, Adam Spencer, the Collegian at a University of Wisconsin, takes down
Collegian, but I think he's done because he was wearing a Nike kit.
Do you think he would have been wearing his Wisconsin kit if he was still representing Wisconsin at the champs?
No, but he wouldn't have been wearing a Nike kit. He was wearing a Nike Pro kit. I'm pretty sure that he's signed professionally. He's not at Wisconsin anymore. I'll check to confirm that right now. I have an inside source on this, but yeah.
Then former Wisconsin runner and 331 guy Adam Spencer beats Ollie Hoare, Cam Myers, Stuart McSwain for the 1500 meter title. So he looks like he's on his way to Paris. Australia is a selection committee, but they do favor their national champions. Jess Hull won the women's 1500. That was expected. as I said earlier, Matthew Ramsden beat Morgan McDonald at the line to win the men's 5K. So the OAC took a tumble in the
Australian Times. Can we talk about the 1500 real quick?
Yeah.
Did you watch the last lap of that race?
I did, yeah.
Adam Spencer just went to the rail and just did not, Centro style, just did not give up the lead. And he just squeezed it down. No, sorry, actually, he made a move on the back stretch to go, but it was not like he just came off the shoulder the last 120. It was he just held the rail the last 200 and made it really tough for anyone. Stuart Mapp is up there. Cam Myers, it looked like he tried to move. And Ollie Hoare was, I think, pretty clearly the second strongest guy in the race, but he was almost outleaned for second. But I think Ollie's been a little bit banged up recently. I imagine that what he did last year and the year before were enough to put him on the team unless he continues to have some subpar performances. But it was a really impressive run. We had a lot of players in this race. Question coming in was Cam Myers on, can Cam Myers win this race? Can Cam Myers make the Olympics? Can Cam Myers make the Olympic final? That was something Matt and I discussed quite a bit. I think I'll stick with Myers' original answer, which is probably not, but still, Myers won the Australian 3K title a few weeks ago. He's one to watch. It was this, watching the last lap of that race just got me really excited for more 1500 meter running later this year. It's been a while. I guess World Indoors weren't that long ago, but it's been a while since we saw it on a proper size track. And yeah, it was a great race. Props to Adam Spencer.
Yeah, it takes down a very strong field. Stuart McSwain, Ollie Hoare. That's a really, it's very similar to the UK 1500 meter final. Probably not quite as strong. You got Whiteman and Kerr there, obviously, the two running champs. So probably not quite as strong, but it's close. I've always said how great a race it would be to see a 4x mile Kenya versus US versus Australia versus UK. Sorry, guys, I think US might struggle in that race, but I think UK and Australia and Kenya would be a showdown for sure. But what else happened in the Australian National Champs, Alex? You looked into this over the weekend while you were obviously in Boston with me, but you were looking into this a bit more.
I guess just in terms of the 800 that we didn't cover, another Australian teenage sensation, Claudia Hollingsworth, won the 800 meter. I think it was like her 19th birthday on the prelim, day of the prelim. So she's pretty young and she's a stellar talent that will definitely be one to watch on the world stage. She's the only on athlete that won a title in Australia. So the OAC came up short. OAC America came up short, but the OAC Australia did well. And then I guess just the men's 800 that I spoke about a little bit earlier. Peter Bull got second and Luke Boyes took him down running 144. So that was an impressive victory for him. I think it's just moving forward to our last point was the Rotterdam Marathon, where Abdi Nagy won a new Dutch national record of 204.45. And Ashete Bekere won by 87 seconds to take the women's title. Just in terms of implications that this has, other than the winners, is Leonard Carrier finished 19th from America. He was trying to go for 208.10, but he ran 212.47. And it's actually looking like the U.S. and Leonard Carrier will go to the Olympics. CJ Albertson's 7th place in Boston actually bumped him above Leonard Carrier in terms of the points. So he's 71 out of 80 people that make the team. And I assume Team GB will send one more, so that will bump CJ to 72. But over the next 2 weeks, when the period ends May 5th, there are not really any other big marathons where people will be running under 208.10 from obscure countries. So it's looking like the U.S. are pretty set, and Leonard Carrier did not run a great race in Rotterdam, but it's looking like the U.S. will send three marathoners, and whether he did well in Rotterdam or not.
What do you guys think about the odds of CJ Albertson coming out and randomly running a marathon in the next few months in 207 and really shaping things up?
I think it's getting too hot. Unless he runs Grandma's in Duluth in June.
Is that outside the period? No, it would be probably inside the period.
Oh, you're talking about doing it for the U.S.? Doing it for... He can't make the team.
He can't make the team.
He can only make... He can only give... He can only ensure Lenny's spot.
Gotcha, yeah.
So if a third American goes, it will be Leonard Carrier. It's okay. If CJ runs 204, all he's doing is he's cementing that Lenny has a spot at the games.
In fact, I think I went through that last week. Apologies. Yeah, just still a bit sleep deprived from the Boston trip. Yeah, fair call. It'll be interesting to see. But yeah, guys, appreciate the time. And we will be back next week with plenty more action from post-London, post-Diamond League. I guess I'll finish off by saying once again, I thank you to the sponsor of this podcast episode, Pillar Performance. You can score 15% off your first order, Pillar Performance, by using Sweat15 or at the feed if you're American by using the same promo code. Thanks, guys. We'll speak to everyone again next week.